Welcome, everybody, to Masterclass this Thursday, November 16th, 2023. We have some great presentations that we'll be having this evening, both narrated and live. So let's get going on the fun and our presenters. Let me get back to those and see who's first. Justin Hunt, are you ready?
Hey, Professor Fury, sorry to bother. I messaged Justin. I sent you an IM about this too. Sorry. I asked if it would be okay if I moved up first. There's some stuff going on this evening, and I was wondering if it was okay if I could move up my slide. I'm sorry.
Yeah, sure. That's fine. Absolutely. You okay. Want to go first?
That'd okay. Be fine if that's okay. Justin, are you still okay
Not
with that?
Not a problem. Okay.
Yeah, that's fine.
Okay. Thank you. I'm sorry.
No problem. No worries. Go right ahead.
Okay, can everybody see that?
Yes.
Perfect. All right, thank you. Good evening, everyone. My name is Rick Pascal. I am presenting the security breaches in healthcare, a huge topic that's been going on over the last few years, especially during the pandemic. I know there were a lot of issues since then, and some glaring issues and vulnerabilities and some data leaks through the healthcare system and also through third-party providers for medical insurance and things of that nature. So it's more of a structural issue and infrastructure and what we are focusing on there. So wanted to cover the overview of it and kind of some impacts and kind of some focuses that they are going through. Overall, the healthcare industry has been suffering some of the highest volumes of cyber attacks and anticipating probably more to even come since even more so than the financial industry. Combine the trend overall with a lot of breach damage costs surpassing several other industries, and there's a horrible warning coming through a cyber attack storm approaching the segment of healthcare data. Recently, the breaches continue to rise. Vulnerabilities enhanced are due to any implementation of new technology that were due to COVID. Businesses or new practices as well with rapid adoption rates. Additionally, there are impacts from the medical data theft from patient risk and additional medical data theft. And then medical plan providers are at major risks. The healthcare sector itself suffered close to about 295 breaches in the first half of this year alone. That's according to the Office for Civil Rights, or OCR, for a reported breach portal that's been created. So far, more than 39 million of individuals have been implicated within healthcare data breaches within the first 6 months. Data breaches this year are through, as I said, June, and the biggest breaches have stemmed from several cybersecurity vulnerabilities, whether it's been third-party software being used, infrastructures not in place, your traditional social engineering that may have come from, and it's been between either healthcare data or hospitals themselves attacking for patient industries as it moves forward. The breach itself has a upward trend. It's been continuing to change over the last 14 years. It's a with the adoption of new rapid information technology, especially since COVID, it's helped with some sort of sorry, I lost my train of thought. My apologies. It's been breached with industries in particular and attractive data breach targets. So healthcare itself is a huge data breach. It's a huge target for them. Healthcare records have names, social securities, date of births, payment information, insurance identification numbers, and protected health information. Healthcare entities themselves hold a large amount of both personal healthcare information and personally identifying information. So with data breach prevention being such a concern, why hasn't that looked into too much more? There's been some counterbalances from the breached data that has kind of created a preparedness for institutions now or hospitals, as notification requirements are now being implemented as regulations of data breaches are occurring. And the data breach response plan is ultimately a way for entities to avoid fines and any type of customer loss. 2021 from breach data itself from prior reports actually was one of the highest data breaches since the Office for Civil Rights was publishing and receiving reports of these trends. From 2009 to 2022, there were over 5,150 data breaches reported between those years. There were still 882 of those still in investigation as of 2022 that did not have any type of HIPAA enforcement actions at that point, whether it came from ransomware or, again, social engineering, some form that came through with data breaches itself. The highest reported breach overall stated that the health records and the electronic health information were the primary targets of it, mostly, as I mentioned prior to, regarding names, social security numbers, dates of birth, and other information for insurance claims and causes. Hacking or IT incidents associated with unauthorized access, disclosure incidents, ransomware, vendor attacks, or direct assaults on these networks are how the bad actors were able to try and implement these attacks overall. Here we have a graph through the trends in the healthcare records, and every breach reported is containing 500 or more records total that have been exposed. And as you can see, year over year, from 2009 to 2023, during the kind of start of the pandemic and leading into this year, there has been a steady climb. It's been a lot of issues as it comes through. The issues reported itself focus on closed cases that are, of course, still being investigated by HIPAA and the OCR, which, again, that is the Office for Civil Rights. One of the biggest itself from this was that the breaches themselves have exposed a disclosure, basically, of 382,262,109 total healthcare records. That equates to almost more than 1.2 times the U.S. population, which is a huge issue. In 2018 alone, there were breaches of 500 or more records that were being reported at around almost one per day. So that itself leading through 2022 is almost an average of 1.94 healthcare data breaches of 500 or more records reported every day. It's kind of eye opening when they move into this segment. There was a decrease that people thought that they were beginning to see, as you can see the drop from 2021 to 22 and now 23. As you could see, they believed that, you know, the infrastructures were being reinforced by healthcare providers and through the healthcare industry. But it appears that bad actors had reinforced their efforts more so than what they were seeing in the financial industry due to the highly profitable data that healthcare plans and healthcare providers provide, unfortunately. A few others for healthcare records exposed, you know, year over year. As we mentioned before, upward trends in exposure. 2015 was actually, outside of the pandemic, had one of the largest data breaches years. It had three major plans involving Anthem, Premier Blue Cross, and Excellus. As you can see in one of the graphs here, Anthem had a total of almost 79 million individuals affected with their breach. Primera had 11 million from hacking or IT incidents for the breach that occurred. Recently, as the most recent one that was one of the larger ones, was the American Medical Collection Agency in 2019. Again, another hacking incident. As you can see, there are a few other issues that came from, mostly with ransomware attacks that had occurred between institutions or from healthcare providers or overall with the science applications of international cooperation, overall just a loss. It was a total data loss where files, everything else just gone. It was a crazy catastrophe that just kind of came through. So, but the incidents themselves, other than the hacking and ransomware, employee errors were another major issue that it came from. Improper medical record viewing, negligence on filings, and data theft all came from it as well, from internal issues. HIPAA and security awareness training has now been implemented a lot by these institutions as a way to try and combat these issues that are continuously growing, to monitor access or to try and aim and reduce any level of the breaches that continue to grow as well. And as you can see on the other side, it's as well from the breaches for the reporting entities, you can see the total number as it just climbs steadily year over year, which is kind of a scary trend. But with COVID, as things changed, as we all know it, healthcare changed, finances changed, education changed. There was a lot that went through. And one of the coinciding factors that led to a lot of these breaches were mostly due to the brief adjustments that what it appeared to within the infrastructures, whether it was remote home functionings, vendor level access issues that may have come through, and just everything during the chaos of the pandemic. Bad actors were ultimately able to take advantage of that and almost farm from an industry that does not put, or apparently does not put, a lot of asset allocation into data security, which is rather unfortunate. This year alone, just a couple of reported breaches, as I mentioned towards the beginning. The Managed Care North America had almost 8.9 million individuals impacted due to a malicious code that was found within their network. It was a very unfortunate event, which the Managed Care of North America itself mostly found that unauthorized party had accessed several portions of their systems and removed complete copies of personal information as it went through. The Managed Care North America contains benefits information from Medicaid all the way to dental records and everything else across several states. Information that was lost was similar to everything else: socials, dates of birth, names, addresses, Medicare information, government issued ID numbers. It was a major disaster that came through that these bad actors were able to gather. PharMerica it's a long-term pharmacy network, had a disclosed breach earlier this year of almost 6 million individuals. They are actually a Fortune 1000 company as well, based out of Kentucky. They discovered a lot of suspicious activity earlier this year around March. And later then also determined that additionally an unknown party had accessed those systems. Again, very similar to the Managed Care North America, the information that was lost was rather unfortunate. Some of those were even from deceased carriers that were trying to be utilized, unfortunately. So complete freezes and notices had to be worked on with HIPAA and with a lot of security firms and institutions like Experian, Equifax, things of that nature. And one of the most recent largest ones up here, actually within my region, Harvard Pilgrim, which is a large healthcare provider up here in the New England area that I'm aware of. My wife, unfortunately, actually was one of these impacted individuals that also, unfortunately, now involves our children from how that actually works. The Harvard Pilgrim itself had a ransomware attack that took all systems offline, and personal information of current and former subscribers and dependents were involved in this ransomware attack. So gathering all these individuals, over 2.5 million, had personal information that was gathered and collected. Since then, Harvard Pilgrim has openly made continuous efforts. They've actually been being very great on communication, which it appears some of these have not, because the reports have been 6 months to a year after investigations have completed, whereas Harvard Pilgrim has been very upfront, notifying their users and open to the public about enhancement of security systems during the aftermath of the event. enhancing any type of user access protocols, vulnerability scannings that they're continuously going through from any endpoint detection and response solutions that may be going through, and even more administrative work through, you know, password resets and trainings as well. As I alluded to earlier, the pandemic was one of the largest purposes or proponents, I would say, in the attacks themselves. COVID-19 generated several new challenges and opportunities for companies operating in the U.S. and the healthcare industry. Health providers were struggling to provide care for their patients due to the pandemic. Even non-COVID-19 patients, they were having issues with it and they needed immediate attention. So there was a challenge that was going through there. And to overcome those restrictions, healthcare providers were hastily trying to implement new hybrid or remote work environments, whether it was, you know, office staff to get out of the way to make room for COVID issues at a hospital and having to now work from home because of the close, you know, proximity to one another. Healthcare providers themselves having to focus more on telemedicine for heavier utilization with infrastructures and networks that were not super secure, which was very unfortunate. So it was a big shift and a big change. But one of the larger pieces was during that time, a new implementation of electronic healthcare records or their systems are going. A lot of companies or organizations were going from paper to digital. And in doing so, the telehealth platform mixed with that and any other remote tools for those collaboration purposes of one-on-one visits or check-ins or things of that nature ultimately opened up several new pathways for cybersecurity attacks against those companies, against those healthcare plan providers, against any type of protected health information. With the premature adoption of these, the success rate of it and the failure rate, it was unable to properly protect the security and the data itself to mix with the privacy of the medical records due to unexpected attack vectors. And the U.S. healthcare industry actually saw a 25% rise in successful cybersecurity attacks during the pandemic. So that was just at the very beginning, as we saw in the graphs earlier, continuing to climb, which was rather unfortunate. One of the risks of advancing health tech. So the pandemic did push a lot of things forward, really making companies realize that they needed to adapt, they needed to reinforce data security and reinforce a lot of infrastructures for them to, within their IT departments as well, to grow and to move into the next phase, whether it was in the financial institution, education, or even in the healthcare industry, because a lot of this health tech was moving into different routes, such as advancements towards drone delivered medical supplies. As we all know, we have, you know, you have Samsung watches or Apple watches or some sort of data wristbands that are collecting your activity or medical information. And they've even started to develop pocket ultrasound devices that have been forcing patients and other healthcare providers to start embracing a lot of these new solutions in the medical field. But it's also leading to that data to be transferred between third party utilization and home utilization between the hospital environments as unsecure points of entry or points of access as it goes through. Technology as itself has additionally created a reluctance in the medical system, in the medical field, on both patient and doctors to adopt a lot of new methods due to concern risks associated with digital care. I myself have never used telehealth, I should say. I know a lot of people have. It is very useful to per se in that, but with telehealth, there's a lot of data being transition between it, because apparently while the provider is having this conversation, they have access to, you know, their medical records while they're having this conversation. And what's not to say that the network is in, you know, not secure from the person's home itself as an access point. It could be from the institution for how they're going to gather this information, because a lot of the health data that's going through there, even if it's collecting data from healthcare watches or anything else, those things track anywhere from, you know, diseases, their fitness sleep, mental health, diets, you know, any type of medical treatments that maybe go on, even all the way to fertility. It's a lot of changes that are going on. But with the advancements, there's still data breaches that continue to have issues, and it leads to more concerns about these changings. And if, you know, rushing into these new segments and new areas are before being properly secured against cyber attacks, such as third-party vendor tools or telemedicine, without properly allocating this asset or the resources to support these changes in the meantime. So it was one of those that during the pandemic, they were doing everything they can, and now it's almost like they're trying to throw a Band-Aid on it and implement these changes. As I mentioned before, going through healthcare apps and what they changed, healthcare apps themselves have been connected devices. They're advised by the FTC for obligation to secure and control the data collected. The FTC does regulate a lot of the data that is collected by those and making certain that they are secure. But with that data being shared amongst medical providers, then exposes any risk associated with it as well. Some of the big issues that come through it outside of the data tracking is that, as a concern, individuals want to be treated by a person rather than some sort of AI, which a lot of people do through, you know, phone medicals or phone urgent cares, before leading anything else. They, or even telemed, like they want to physically, be in front of someone. The issue as well with data tracking and technology within healthcare as well is that the software in the hospitals can tend to be faulty, causing delays in treatment or even misapplying treatment, as there have been instances where there was a software failure that had a incident. It was in 2013 where a patient was actually given 38 times the dose of the regular medication due to faulty information within the electronic healthcare records. It never updated that continuously they had been given the doses or the doses were changed or anything else. So I know since then things have changed, but there still unfortunately has not apparently been a failsafe to see a lot of these issues within data privacy or even healthcare record updates. Additionally, a lot of people are concerned with these changes with that are financial incentives for these institutions to start using new products and new digitization of records, and not saying keeping things in the Stone Age, but they need to be able to reinforce these losses and these updates and these reports that are going through. So the biggest question is, why is healthcare continuously being attacked? Why is it more so than, you know, the financial field? Financial technically is still one of the highest attacked fields, but with cybersecurity incidents outside of that, healthcare is just behind it as a very close number two, moving a little bit further. Breaches within healthcare vary from credential stealing malware to insider errors or even hardware lost overall. Personal healthcare information is a highly valuable asset on the black market. Sorry, that should say black market, not back market. My apologies. More than credit card credentials or even personal identifiable information, because it leads to a greater incentive for cyber criminals to sell. Health information is more valuable, as a criminal can continue to use that information for fraud in either targeting the victim or scams that could take use of any type of medical condition, create false settlements or insurance claims, and lead to purchase or possibly even resale of medical equipment that they've claimed to be used as the individual. Overall, the profit per record stolen for personal health information is $355 per individual. So think about that on when one report is filed to the OCR, of a report of 500 or more records being compromised, one of those records is worth $355. So it could potentially be worth $355. So it's extremely profitable for cyber criminals. And that's one of the reasons that they're focusing on this, because of the lack of infrastructure and the lack of security that has been implemented into this due to the pandemic and adoption of new technology as well without protection. The protection itself, you know, what do we have? Overall, the FTC has a health breach notification now. Overall, the FTC Act was implemented because, of course, you know, we care about our privacy and the security of our health related information. With the FTC, that means that any breach notification rule makes certain that if an entity has been breached, The company itself must take specific steps within that breach in either notification and communication of that to the individuals that were breached, and far as regulations or penalties go, face that. So it is a big piece to where if any time there's an outbreach, it must be reported and rolled out for what the next steps are and the plans too. Of course, we know we have HIPAA, which is overall the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act that maintains any sensitive health information that has been compromised, and they're ensuring that medical data has been insured. So they're working with the FTC on this as well, making certain that vendors with pertaining health records or health-related entities must notify U.S. consumers. Of course, the FTC, the HIPAA is requiring this. And in some cases, even media, if there's been a breach that is large enough that it must be known, otherwise face civil penalties or violations towards it. Additionally, there are forms of state regulations that have been coming through for data protection rights on the medical side of things. The U.S. Department of Health and Information, or the Department of Health and Human Services, they don't mandate what electronic platforms are being utilized, but they are encouraging heavily on utilizing the NIST guidance documents for when choosing a secure provider. There's a lot of policies and regulations that go through it and leading to failure to comply with HIPAA regulations. For a breach, the annual limit or penalty is around almost $2 million per tier and about $50,000 per individual as a penalty towards that as well. And that's implemented by the state. Overall, one of the biggest issues is a protection, I should say, not an issue, but a protection, is the new IT infrastructures. I mentioned that the FTC is working on the breaches. We've been seeing the slight decreases in healthcare attacks itself. So infrastructures are starting to be pushed further. Cybersecurity is becoming a huge investment in healthcare. It does tend to lag behind other industries, as only healthcare spends about 6 to 10% of its overall IT budget on cybersecurity. Since COVID and all these breaches that have been going on, a projected increase in spending towards cybersecurity has been almost increased to 51% amongst the industry. The data breaches themselves have been reduced when organizations have been implementing tools and teams dedicated to protecting and responding to any data breaches or suspicion of unauthorized access. And the healthcare industry itself has reported to a cost savings of almost $2 million per incident since going through that and actually utilizing some other instances within teams and some small forms of artificial intelligence to help mitigate any of these issues. So overall, in summary, my apologies, I may have went on a little bit longer, but in summary, protecting patients' sensitive data or complying with regulations has been preventing unauthorized access and ensuring patient safety, ultimately preventing data breaches or supporting research and maintaining trust within healthcare sectors, as healthcare data security is extremely important. And to safeguard sensitive data effectively, it's extremely vital for healthcare organizations now to invest in a more robust security measure, employee training, and technological solutions. This is my references and questions. Sorry. Thank you.
That was intense. That is a lot of information.
Yeah, that was a great presentation too. Good job.
Yeah, awesome.
Thank
Very
you.
Very cool.
Yeah, it's something I am passionate about with it, especially my wife in the medical field. I mean, she deals with a lot of it, and just, it's insane to hear some of the stuff with how some people access particular things, unfortunately. But it was very eye-opening during the research.
Well, it's pretty sad too, because we consider our stuff, especially with HIPAA, we consider our stuff when we go to the hospital and, or, you know, the doctors and stuff, we consider that to be protected, classified.
Yeah, and that's our assumption, that it should be that case. But unfortunately, it continues to go. And it seems to be that hospitals are actually getting better with it. And now it's more towards in line with the healthcare carriers themselves. So your Blue Crosses, your United Healthcares, things of that nature, pharmaceutical companies that maintain these records. And it's just a vicious cycle, unfortunately. And hopefully now they're starting to get the picture. But the pandemic changed a lot of it. And it was just easy pickings, unfortunately.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. And yes, Charles, I do agree. I do think that a lot of it probably was from medical systems using outdated technology. As I mentioned, resource allocation was not where it should have been, especially moving hastily into a digital age for medicine. And it just left a lot on the table that needed to be, you know, corrected or scooped up. Yeah, thanks. Sorry if I went a little over, but I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you so much. That was wonderful. Great job. Okay. Next we have Jason. Are you ready?
How are you guys doing? Yes.
Doing good.
All right, good. So let me see. I'm going to test something real quick. You guys let me know what you see on your screen. Is that okay?
Okay.
All righty. Give me one moment. To quickly set this up. Okay. One moment here. So do you guys see my presentation or do you guys see like a whole UI around it? What do you guys see?
We see Alexa. What are virtual assistants?
That's it?
The internet. Well, the image that you made for the slide.
Okay, good. All right. So welcome, everyone. Welcome to my masterclass presentation. I hope you guys are doing well. Today, I will be discussing what are virtual assistants, going through a brief history of the technology, its features and capabilities. We'll also touch base on an influence that virtual assistants has on modern day culture, media, and entertainment. And well, actually, that's how I'm going to be closing off the presentation. But before that, we'll discuss the future. What does the future hold for VAs as a whole? So to start off, what is the history for virtual assistants? A brief history, as you will, if you will. So in the 1960s, it all started back with the introduction of the first interactive voice response systems. So as you guys can see here by this image, very, very old school, very basic, very classic. There's not really much going on. It's very typewriter-esque, right? When you look at this type of technology at first. And the input device, as you can see here, is a literal telephone, a literal pickup telephone. And people would use this telephone to input voice commands that way. So a very basic idea for the technology. So we transitioned to 1996, where Clippy was then introduced. This is where voice assistants gained a huge bump in popularity, and this is where Microsoft wanted to give their first take and their first iteration of the technology, excuse me. So with Clippy was basically an animated paperclip for Microsoft. This was pretty much like a little fun animated assistant of yours that would help you execute certain commands on your Windows machine. Now, one thing I do want to point out through these virtual assistants is the fact that over time, they begin to have their own brand or identity. So we started off with something that was very basic and very bland at first, to something that had a name, something that had a brand to it, something that had a logo to it and an image, excuse me. And going forward with Alexa or Google Assistant and Siri, Apple Siri, you see that trend going forward, that these systems begin to have a brand and a particular identity. So now that this leads us to 2011 and present day, where we have our well-known virtual assistants like Apple Siri in 2011, Amazon's Alexa, and Google Assistant. This, for me, can be seen as like a huge turning point for this technology as a whole, once Siri first got introduced in 2011 and going forward. And who knows, I mean, what other virtual assistant will be direct competition with these big three giants, but we'll have to wait and see what happens going forward. So next, we'll touch base on the features and capabilities. So these are the four main ones that I got out of during my research. We have voice interaction, task automation, information retrieval, and personalized assistance using AI. So in voice interaction, of course, this is the main way that you interact with virtual assistants. Everything is done through your voice and through your voice only. There's no hand-on interaction. There's no haptic interaction. There's no on-screen or touchscreen interaction. Everything is done through your voice. So this also allows, like I stated, for hands-free communication and making that a reality just by using your voice. Feature slash capability number two is task automation. We have tasks being automated from reminders to making phone calls, managing calendars, and making online purchases. Some of these features are features that not a lot of people tend to use. For example, online purchases can be considered a risky feature because you don't want to accidentally activate Siri and then tell Siri, oh yeah, I want to buy a $1,000 smartphone or something that wasn't like provoked or planned, right? I feel like with a feature like that, being able to make online purchases, it can bring a little bit of risk down the line. But yeah, those are just some of the features that are included in the task automation side of things. Next is a very common feature with these technologies is information retrieval. With the use of online databases, virtual assistants can give instant access to information such as weather updates and news, and also conduct search queries and figure out certain facts about animals or celebrities, finding out their age. Even with athletes, you can even ask Siri what a particular team that does an athlete play for, and you'll be able to get that information in an instant with virtual assistants. And then the last feature I have listed here is personalized assistance with the use of AI. Now, I feel like AI and virtual assistants kind of go hand in hand. They're kind of like siblings in a way. These technologies, if you mention one, the other will also be mentioned no matter what, because they correlate with one another. So through AI-based algorithms, virtual assistants can learn the preferences and habits of users to tailor recommendations and responses accordingly. Now, a perfect example that I can think of this includes Siri with Siri suggestions. Now, I just activated Siri by saying her name. But now with Siri suggestions, you can pretty much have app suggestions or task suggestions listed for you. So once you swipe down on iOS and you bring up your spotlight search, you notice that Siri will give you suggestions for any particular app that you would want to open or any task that you would want to do, like texting somebody or making a phone call. That is pretty much your personalized assistance. Siri learns from your daily user habits and will give you app suggestions and task suggestions that are based on what you're doing on your daily basis when it comes to using your iPhone. So these are four of the main features and capabilities that I've covered through my research and through my time of my masterclass. Now, next, this is the big age-old debate, right? When you debate any piece of technology, you debate which one is the best, which one has it all, which one could definitely be considered the GOAT of that particular technology. So these are the four that I was able to gather for this slide. These are the most common ones that I was able to gather. One of them that I don't really see in a lot of conversations or really like when it comes to just use is Bixby. So Samsung Bixby, out of all four of these, I feel like Bixby is not really mentioned a lot. You guys can correct me on that if you want to. But Bixby, if I had to rank these, Bixby would obviously be fourth because I don't really see Bixby a lot compared to these other big three. But yeah, so Siri is exclusive to Apple and their ecosystem of devices and services, as you guys may know. Apple has this very big niche of exclusivity and keeping their technologies and services tailored and optimized just for their pieces of hardware and just for their pieces of software. So you can only really access Siri through Apple devices and Apple technologies. You can't really access Siri nowhere else unless somebody out there is good at jailbreaking and they somehow get Siri on Android, right? There's multiple capabilities within technology and within IT. You just never know. But usually, Siri is locked through Apple services and Apple products only. Once again, you guys can debate me on that and correct me on that if you can. That's completely fine. I'm open to conversation. But also, Siri still has a long way to go when it comes to overall functionality and intelligence. there's still a lot of areas that these operating systems commonly where they lack capabilities and where they lack overall functionality and just intelligence, but there's still room for improvement. And I feel like Sirius is one of those virtual assistants that can definitely be improved more. I mean, just recently with the release of iOS 17, they've changed a lot with Siri. You're able to just activate Siri just by saying Siri. You don't have to have that initial verbiage with hey in the beginning of that phrase. You just have to say her name or his if you have it as a male. You just got to say the name of the virtual assistant and then she'll be able to conduct tasks and do commands. And also you can do back-to-back queries and commands. So before, once you ask your virtual assistant Siri to do something, she'll automatically, disappear or deactivate after one particular command. Now within iOS 17, you can do, I think, up to like 3 or 4 back-to-back. So you can say something like, Siri, look this up for me. And then Siri, look this other fact for me right after that. And even after that, you can make a phone call. So it's just more flexibility and functionality now with iOS 17 when it comes to Siri. And like I said, there's still room for improvement. And I feel like Siri definitely has room for improvement when it comes to just overall features and capabilities. Now with Google Assistant, for all my Android peeps, right? Google Assistant is available with all or compatible with all Android devices. And it's available to download on iOS. So unlike the vendor lock style of Siri, where you can only really access Siri on Apple products, Google Assistant is now its own thing. It's now its own app. Google Assistant was just originally part of Google's search feature. But now since it's integrated as its own app, you could download Google Assistant from the App Store and use it as you will. If you prefer Google Assistant over Siri or Android over iOS, which is always a great thing. Having that accessibility and compatibility, right? So like I said, Bixby, out of these four, is definitely the least common one, at least for me. So Bixby shares a lot of the common features with other virtual assistants, such as making phone calls and launching apps, the typical stuff that you would do with a virtual assistant. Some features that sets the assistant apart, though, include toggling auto-rotate on and off, taking selfies, and replying to emails within Gmail. So those are just a couple of features that you could use to distinguish Bixby from everybody else. And then, of course, last but not least is Amazon Alexa. And this is obviously a common one within everybody. Even if you're not that tech savvy, somebody's going to have an Amazon Alexa somewhere within their home. So with Alexa, one of the biggest features that I found very interesting while conducting my research is this feature called Alexa Guard. Now, this pretty much acts like a security intrusion system. This allows users to monitor suspicious activity, such as broken glass or alarm triggers, and it could be triggered or activated by using a simple command, such as Alexa, I'm heading to work. So a feature that I really found really interesting. It's pretty much your own security system within the virtual assistant, so it's pretty awesome. And then just this last point here, like I said at the beginning of the slide, these are considered the big four, on air quotes, when it comes to virtual assistants, each set with their own capabilities and imperfections. Like I said, all these VAs and technologies have room for improvement, so they're definitely not perfect when it comes to overall functionality as a whole. So determining which one is the best really just depends on your personal preference, what you prefer, and what ecosystem are you under. So if you're under a major ecosystem of Android devices, or if you're under a iOS ecosystem where it's all just Apple products, that's a big determining factor that'll determine if you want to use one over the other. So I just have a little video here. It's an 11-minute video, but I'm not going to show the full thing. It's by fellow YouTuber Marquez Brownlee, MKBHD. I don't know if you guys are familiar with him. He makes a lot of tech videos, and he made this one recently this year, pretty much detailing this entire debate. So the virtual assistant debate and which one is really considered the best. I'm only going to show like 2 to 3 minutes of it, of him just comparing like basic simple questions and functionality between the four VAs. Can you guys hear that actually? Oh gosh, can you guys hear that? Yes, okay, good. Thank you. Thank you. All right, so at the end there, it's a very valid point that when it comes to search queries, you oftentimes find that Siri heavily relies on Wikipedia, where other virtual assistants like Google Assistant kind of gives you like that direct answer and a direct result. So that's kind of just a minor comparison between the four and, like I said, the four giants, if you will, when it comes to VAs. All right, so next, what is the future for virtual assistants? Three major keys and three major aspects that I gathered here for this slide. The first one here is having more virtual assistant employees. Now, I know this sounds crazy on paper because people fear that 15 to 20 to 30 years down the line, human employees will eventually get replaced by all these technologies and all these integrations and people have talked about having humanoid androids and pretty much all the stuff that you see in like movies, all the stuff that we see through movies and all the stuff that we've seen throughout media. People fear that that's going to happen. Now, it's not a fear that you should really hold on to and be like, oh my gosh, this is the end of the world. It's more just like, let's welcome this in. Let's welcome this new movement and see what happens. Let's see how it can impact our society or the way that we do things within work as a whole. So with virtual assistants, due to the advancements within tech, it has made it possible for people to work remotely, which has made it possible for people to work remotely. They can even provide more complex services, such as social media management, content creation, and customer service. So like I said, rather than holding onto this and having this be for fear, this is more like, let's see how this can benefit us as a society. And let's see how this can kind of be like a welcoming change. At least that's how I see it. I don't know if that's just shows my love for technology, but I don't really have that fear that a lot of people have nowadays that we're all going to be replaced by technology, especially within the workforce. But change or aspect number two is having virtual assistant advancements does equal higher demand. Now, all these advancements equal a higher demand. As more businesses and individuals rely on virtual assistants to handle administrative tasks, the demand for virtual assistant employees will increase, which can also lead to more job opportunities and higher salaries. Now, who doesn't want to have more job opportunities and potentially a higher salary? I mean, right, we are an internship group. We're all part of a company. Having more opportunities and having higher paid salaries. Doesn't matter. At least it's not in a legal fashion, right? But if it's involved in tech, that's the best thing possible. So just having those opportunities within a workplace like ourselves, like PGIP Tech, is going to be a great thing going forward and going down the line for years to come. Now, my last key aspect here is virtual and augmented reality will become more widespread. So technologies like mixed reality, virtual reality, and augmented reality will become more popular, more widespread, helping users to feel more connected to their work colleagues. Examples of this would be Metaverse and Apple Vision Pro. And Apple Vision Pro. Now, say what you want to say about Meta or Mark Zuckerberg, love him or hate him. The Metaverse is an interesting concept. It is something that is intriguing. Being able to just be in your own personal virtual realm and being able to work and make profit and make money through this virtual space. Now, obviously, the one thing that people are scared of is escaping the real world, like escaping being able to interact with real people in real life, escaping being able to connect with nature, just escaping your actual physical world as a whole is always a thought in mind when you think of technologies like the Metaverse or like virtual. Yeah, an introvert stream, correct. Like virtual or augmented reality, that's one of the biggest things that people always have in mind is, will I not be in tune with the real world after I put this headset on and spend hours dwelling in my virtual space, right? So, but yet again, we can't just think about the negatives. We have to take positives out of this and say, maybe this will bring benefit. Maybe this will be helpful for people who can't really commute to work every single day, or people that just, like Kyle said, people who are introverted and they don't like people. So they'd rather just be in their own virtual space, right? So we always got to take out the positives and not just let the negatives of these technologies overshadow that, if that makes sense. So yeah, that's what the future is looking like for these technologies, and having virtual and augmented reality integrated into it is always a great thing. And I'm looking forward to see what happens with Metaverse and Apple's Vision Pro, which is their first time doing a virtual or mixed reality headset. First time Apple has ever delved into this or dive into this type of market. And we'll see what happens. The headset's supposed to come out by 2024. If any of you guys are familiar with that, let me know for any thoughts or questions at the end of my presentation. It's a very, very fun thing that we're heading into when it comes to these technologies as a whole. So, okay, to close off, we have a fun little slide here, and that is the influence of virtual assistants within modern-day culture, modern-day media, and entertainment. Now, we have Jarvis. Now, if any of you are comic book fans or Marvel fans, you guys are going to be familiar with obviously Tony Stark and Iron Man, but most importantly is Jarvis. Now, this is Tony Stark's AI virtual assistant companion. He automates all of Tony's tasks and can relay information even while Tony Stark and Iron Man is in combat. So whether that be vitals, heart rates, oxygen, Jarvis obviously gives all that information to Iron Man and to Tony Stark. He also really suits as an Internet of Things device because Tony doesn't really have to have a suit on to really communicate with Jarvis. If you guys seen all the MCU movies or know from the comics, Jarvis can be anywhere within Stark Industries Tower, Tony can be elsewhere, and he can still find a way to communicate with Jarvis, with Tony, no matter what. A suit doesn't have to be on for him to really communicate with his virtual AI companion. And most importantly here, Jarvis has personality. I mean, he's literally British, right? He has a British accent. He doesn't come off as robotic as most virtual assistants that we know in real life today. So that's just Jarvis for you guys. I have a little clip here of just some Iron Man scenes with Tony Stark and Jarvis. I'm only going to be showing like 2 minutes of this, and that's how we're going to be closing off. You guys can hear that, right? Confirm. Thank you. All right, thanks. I would show more, but I wasn't given permission to show an entire MCU movie. But hopefully you guys enjoyed, and that'll be it. These are just my references. If you guys want the video, the link to the video for Marquez's video, it's here. I can find a way to post it onto the chat and everything else. Thank you, everyone. This was very nerve-wracking for me, coming out here and publicly speaking and presenting this. I was anticipating this for an entire month. So I'm glad I finally got this out the way and I was able to give a good presentation. If you guys have any questions or comments, let me know. Thank you.
Fantastic. Thank you for the entertainment. Yes,
no problem. No problem. Thank you.
No, that was great. Great information.
Comments?
I mean, not only that, the entertainment from all of our assistants going off while you kept saying their names.
Right? Did that happen?
It did. I had both the ape one and the G one talking.
That's
my,
funny.
My Apple went off a couple of times.
Right.
Yeah.
It happened to me when I said Siri a couple of times as well.
Exactly.
But yeah.
At least they know their name.
Triggered. Right.
No, that was excellent. Thank you so much. That was great.
Thank you guys for giving me the time. Appreciate it. Thank you.
Great job. Okay, next in line, if I can get to it. Alyssa, are you ready?
I am. All right, let me share my screen here, if I can get this. Okay. Oh. Can everybody see that?
Yes, but we see it not as a full presentation. We see it in the SharePoint. I mean, in the PowerPoint.
Let me start then. Can you see that?
Yes.
Perfect. All right. So my topic is the history and some variants of ransomware. All right. So what is ransomware? Ransomware is referenced as malware designed to access files on a user's computer. The program is used to encrypt files and demand a certain payment to have the files decrypted using a decryption key. The method behind these attacks is to corner the user into giving the hacker money, as it is easier to do than try to fix the issues themselves. It can have devastating effects on any company, especially targeting medical facilities for their large databases of patient information. So it starts by receives a spammed message. The attachment is downloaded with the malware connecting. The crypto ransomware is downloaded to the computer. Files are affected, and then the ransomware message is displayed. Thus, the victims must use a browser or use Bitcoin to pay them back. There are three phases, the infection, encrypting, and demanding phases of ransomware. Like mentioned, ransomware is a form of malware to gain access into another user's system, such as through phishing emails and malicious download, a link to an unknown website, or maybe through a hacked program like remote desktop protocol. With this, the hacker has control of the user's computer and other devices that would give up their files with some compensation. The encryption phase is normally through the computer's operating system by accessing the files, encrypting them through a hacker encryption key, and then replacing the files with encrypted versions. To demand for the ransom, a hacker will often change the background of a ransom note or replace files with ransom note demands with some sort of instructions for them to exchange of cryptocurrency. If paid, the hacker will often send a symmetric encryption key to decrypt the user's files. The history of ransomware started in 1989 by a Harvard student named Joseph L. Popp, and it was called the 1989 AIDS Trojan, or mentioned by as the PS Cyborg. It was an attack on the World Health Organization's International AIDS Conference to infect 20,000 infected diskettes. I can never say that right. The attack would encrypt a user's name on files and hide directories on their computers after 90 reboots. If a user were to send $189 to the post office box in Panama City, Florida, to the PC Cyber Corporation, they could gain access back. Pop was eventually caught, however, was unfit to stand trial for his actions, citing insanity, and was never tried for this kind of crime. So now we go into outbreaks. The great boom of ransomware attacks came to start in 2017 with the WannaCry outbreak. This outbreak created a large-scale ransomware attacks on big-name companies. These attempts were essentially to gain thousands of dollars by hijacking various company devices. COVID-19 was also another contributor to another surge of attacks, as most offices were forced to perform duties and tasks online. This surge of ransomware attacks spread through Microsoft Windows on computers and servers due to lack of awareness and outdated systems. The hack was founded by the Shadow Brokers, also known as Internal Blue, which exploited the vulnerability of Microsoft Windows. Data withheld and encrypted by users whose computers were affected by the malware. For a ransom, the $300 was the demand in bitcoins, and then later increased to 600 if users wished to gain back their data. The attack affected around 230,000 computers, with around $4 billion in loss from other countries and individuals around the world. There are different kinds of ransomware variants. Maze is the first, which encrypted files and performed data theft at the same exact time. This program collected sensitive data from users' computers and encrypted it. If the demands were not met, the data was then exposed online to the highest bidder, with more than often than on the dark web. This group was responsible for Maze had officially disbanded. However, the growing concern is how this variant is worming its way into another ransomware. Lockbit is the next one. It was created in 2019 and was developed to take down large organizations with powerful encryption techniques quickly and preventing any detection along the way. Ryuk was another targeted variant and is delivered by hacking the remote desktop protocol or using spear phishing emails. Access to these programs allowed the ransomware to encrypt specific types of files and demand cryptocurrency for data in return. It is the most expensive variant of ransomware and asks well over $1 million for the decryption key, thus why this type of focuses on large companies. DearCry was designed from Microsoft Exchange vulnerabilities in 2021. This type of variant focuses on encrypting specific types of files and instructing users to send them an email to have their files decrypted with a fee, though the amount varies with that. So here's the evolution and trends. Started in 1989 with the AIDS Trojan, which spread via floppy disk or diskettes and used symmetric cryptography with monitor boot time count. The second one was in 2004 with the GP code. It spread through phishing emails and used asymmetric cryptography with encrypted My Documents through Microsoft. And as you can see, there is a lot of Microsoft ransomware attacks. 2012, the Riveton spread through outdated plugins. CryptoLocker spread through, again, phishing emails. SPEG was also another one, but it also did its harm through email attachments. Encoder was in 2015, and it spread through the backdoor of Magneto CMS. In 2016, another flaw was found in BitTorrent, which bypassed the gatekeeper to infect the system. The WannaCry, of course, we just talked about in 2017. The flaw was in the SBM server and used asymmetric cryptography. And then in 2020, again, this hasn't been updated as far as the newest one, but it spread through the COVID-19 and used the VP script for UAC bypassing. So how do you protect yourself from ransomware? There are essentially four practices that can reduce, well, technically five, that can greatly reduce the amount of attacks on a system and our network. The first is to have complete awareness of the situation. There should be training for employees discussing the repercussions of a mock situation compared to a real one. Since most ransomware is spread through phishing emails, training employees to always check their email addresses would greatly reduce the risks involved. Another practice is to have continuous protected data backups. Having backups can help an organization recover their data without giving in to the hacker's demands. And a secured backup is something that cannot be overwritten or corrupted by data. The next best practice is called patching. Patching is when there's a vulnerability and a patch is made to fix the issue. Whether this is done by updating a system or the program, it must be done with all the systems to prevent a hacker from gaining access. The last practice is to utilize user authentication. Strong authentication, such as implementing biometrics or two-factor authentication, can greatly reduce the chances of a system being hacked. And then finally, anti-ransomware solutions. If malware does not end up compromising a system, there are methods to help detect and act upon the threat. They are automatic restoration, wide variant detection, restoration mechanism, and fast detection. And then here is how we mitigate through an active ransomware infection. There are six steps. The first is to quarantine the infected machine. If there is a detection on a specific machine, the ransomware will spread quickly. Therefore, it's essential to isolate the machine by disabling the wireless internet, pull out any wires connected to the device, or shut down the systems around the affected machine to limit the infection. The second step is to leave the computer on to keep volatile memory safe, as encryption of the files can make the computer or system unstable if powered off. The third is to have a backup. As mentioned before, it is important to have private and essential files on a protected backup drive. Number four is to look for any solutions to decrypt the files. Investigation of a decryption software can help restore the files without giving into the ransom's demand. Number five is asking for an expert's help. Digital forensics investigators may have advice or ways to fix this solution. Number six is to wipe the machine and restore it from a clean backup operating system to ensure that the malware is deleted from the server. And those are my references.
Great job. That was great seeing all that.
Thank you, guys. I was super nervous.
Sure. But you did very well.
Thank you.
Yeah. It's always good to know about that stuff because you want to protect yourself, right? See how it happens. All right. I think we have one that was kind of skipped a few times. Are you still here? We didn't put you to sleep, did we? Let's see, I'm trying to get in there. Where's my list? Is it Justin?
Hello.
Was that you? Yeah.
Yeah.
Hello.
Hi. Can you see my screen?
Yes.
So my topic is on VR in the workplace. And I wanted to choose this topic for my current occupation is with Walmart. And we have some VR that we use for training. I haven't had the chance to use it myself, but I've heard stories of people who have used it, and they always sound very interesting. So, what is VR? VR is a simulated 3D environment created with computer hardware and software. And with the use of a headset or goggles, it gives the users the ability to interact with the environment. Thanks to the popularity of remote work, some employers are finding it a lot harder to find candidates with the soft skills that they're looking for. But VR has made it easier for people to learn and actually retain the information that they need during their onboarding process, which I have noticed a lot with a lot of the new hires that we get. It seems like the onboarding, they're not remembering as much like year after year. And I really think if we would use our VR more often, it might help, because we do get a lot of younger people. And sometimes sitting in a room for just a couple of weeks, just staring at a computer screen, you start to get a little bored of it. And being able to interact with a VR headset, I think, would really help them a lot. There are several types of VR. There's non-immersive, semi-immersive, and fully immersive. A non-immersive VR is just a 3D rendering on your screen similar to video games, and the users have limited control over the environment with the use of keyboard and mouse. A semi-immersive environment is accessed by either the computer screen or the headset and glasses. You don't use your physical movement. It's similar to flight simulators that the airlines and military use to train their pilots. And then we have the fully immersive, which incorporates sound, sight, and sometimes touch. This is probably the one more people are familiar with like the Oculus Rift and the Vive headsets. You would use a headset, goggles, or a helmet, and gloves or handheld devices. But when most people think of VR, they probably think of it as a video game, but it's more than a video game. VR provides a lot of occupations, such as firefighters, EMTs, police officers, soldiers, and surgeons, with efficient and safe ways to train. Teachers can provide new ways of engaging with their students by bringing 2D objects to life, or being able to experience different parts of the world from the classroom. Within retail, customers have the ability to try on clothes, see how furniture would look in their home before buying it. And there are many more applications, and VR has only scratched the surface of it. The uses in the workplace for VR come from employee training, improving marketing, teamwork, and collaboration. Employees can use VR to safely be trained to perform tasks without putting others in harm's way, and it can also be used by employees working in different locations to collaborate on projects. Because remote work is becoming more popular, and everybody is trying to get that job from home, and VR can make it much easier to connect with everybody in the company. The improvements that VR has on retail seem to be almost endless. Several clothing stores offer a VR fitting room, as well as, according to my research, they have it was like a virtual like fashion show. So instead of actually being there in person, I think they have a camera set up, and so you would see from the perspective of that camera. And with the VR fitting rooms, it gives you an idea of how certain clothing looks on you, as well as jewelry. And even some of them will offer style recommendations. The try before you buy gives a lot of customers a greater sense of involvement and interaction, which can make them more willing to buy the product. And VR can also be used in a remodeling process to get a good understanding of how everything will look and help you make the best decision. But there are a lot of pros to VR, I think, but there are a lot of cons as well. So VR equipment can be kind of expensive, especially on the startup, because to make applications for VR can take up to 8 weeks for a basic one and cost a minimum of about $15,000. A more advanced application takes up to, I think it was 10 weeks and could cost around $30,000. And as we all know, anything technology related can be hacked, and VR headsets come equipped with cameras and microphones. And depending on the companies, they might store the training that they've used with their associates somewhere on a server to be reviewed later. So it could definitely has a way of getting into your company's network. But with the full immersion systems, people tend to experience nausea, disorientation, as well as neck and shoulder strain. And I can speak from experience on this one. Wearing a headset for like 30 minutes, you can really start to feel it weighing down on your neck. And it really does cause some problems there, as well as the disorientation. Because if you haven't ever played with a VR system, you don't understand how immersive it truly is. And I have done some research, and people were saying how someone was able to hack into a VR headset and remove the boundaries that it has put in place to keep you from running into something in the real world. And they removed them, and people were crashing into walls or even falling downstairs. So that's definitely a concern when using these and socializing. When you get so used to using VR or even remote work, you kind of forget to connect to actual people. And the more we use that, and I feel like progressing the world, the more of a reality that becomes. A lot of people are not socializing as much as we used to, and everything's becoming more online. And like online shopping, people don't go into stores as often. You order stuff, you have it sent straight to your house, and you cut out the middleman, really, which can be good, but also has a lot of negative effects as well. So even though VR has made great strides in how we can interact with users and other employees, there is still a lot that can be improved upon, but I foresee it becoming a more commonly used product in a lot of companies. Like they always say, the only constant in this world is change, so we either accept these changes or get stuck in the past. Any questions?
No, that was great. Excuse me. Excellent job. Does anybody have any questions? Yeah, definitely amazing. Good job.
Thank you.
Okay, so I have one that I need to do for a former intern for his masterclass, and I hadn't gotten to it yet. See if I can pull it up. Okay, I may not pull it up because the volume is so low. Let's see what we can do here. Let me try and put it where it needs to go. Okay, can everybody see the screen? All right. Let's try it. I'm not too sure about the sound. I might not let it go too long because if you can't hear it, it's not going to help, but we'll see what happens.
Hi, everyone. I'm Eric Jess, and today I'll be talking about the implementation of steganography in the context of an Android app that I wrote a while back. So first, just a very short explanation of steganography, and I will try to keep this short because Shay has already given such an excellent presentation explaining the concept a few weeks ago, that for my purposes here, I'll just say steganography is basically the practice of hiding one message inside of another message or object. And the basic advantage it has over cryptography as a means of hiding or obscuring a message is that when done properly, the message or object containing the message should be indistinguishable from a copy of that same message or object which does not contain the message. So for the purposes of the app I made, which I'll be talking about here, the hidden message will be a string and the containing object will be a picture. So our goal is to embed that message within the picture without noticeably altering the picture's dimensions or appearance. So moving on to the actual app now, I called it StegCaption, which was short for steganographic caption, which described its intended functionality of adding a hidden caption to an image. The app works by embedding a string text within a picture without noticeably altering it. The image can then be resent or shared with the message embedded, and that message can be retrieved from the image with the app. The use case I imagined for this app when I wrote it was to share secret messages through images that the user might be sharing on social media or texting to another user of the app. For an additional layer of security, the message is also password protected using a simple exclusive OR cipher that I will discuss shortly. This is an Android app that I wrote a while back, and I haven't really revisited it much in probably a year or so. The origin of this app came from a Kotlin project I did on a site called JetBrains Academy, which is a subscription learning site from JetBrains, who are the company behind the IntelliJ IDE, which Android Studio is also based on, and they're the developers of the Kotlin language itself, which Google has designated as the preferred language for Android development a few years ago. So I've been learning Kotlin, although I still do practice writing Android apps in Java as well. So the original project was a console app written in Kotlin, meant to demonstrate the principles of steganography and cryptography by embedding a text message within a message, within an image, and protecting it with a password. After I had successfully solved this project, it occurred to me that it would make a much more useful Android app rather than text-based console app. So I set out to bring it to Android and also extend the functionality a bit, as well as to try to seamlessly integrate it with social media or messaging usages. And I tried to do that through various options I'll show later, like copy-paste functionality and mainly a share button functionality that can integrate directly with other apps on your Android device. As I mentioned, this app was a work in progress when I moved on to other things, so there are a lot of fixes, updates, and improvements that I need to make that I noticed going back through it. And actually, so many that I have a to-do list live later on where I'll talk about a few of them. Also, I'd like to mention the UI wasn't my main focus at the time. I was treating this more like a proof of concept demo for the steganography logic, so you will notice the interface is not at a finished level. So now we'll talk about the high-level view of how we go about hiding a text message within an image, as well as encrypting that message with a simple password implementation. First, we'll encrypt the message using something called an exclusive OR cipher, which is a simple cipher using the exclusive OR logic gate, and I'll talk about that on the next slide. So then after we have the encrypted version of our message string, we will need to store that as an array of bytes, which each byte capable of storing one character of the message. We will then store those bytes, one bit at a time, within the RGB color information of the pixels of the image. And we do that by storing only one bit in what is known as the least significant bit of the color byte for each pixel. And that concept of least significant bit, I'll come back to in a minute here. Also, when we access the color information of each pixel, we get an RGB value with all three components, the red, green, and the blue. And we could take advantage of this to choose which color value we're encoding our message on, and also therefore encode up to three messages per image, one on each RGB component. Now we'll get into a little more detail about how the exclusive OR cipher works, and then later I'll go through the actual code a bit to let you see how to implement it. You're probably familiar with logic statements like and OR, so just to review, like an AND logic gate would return true if and only if both elements being evaluated were true, and an OR logic gate would return true if either element is true. An exclusive OR returns true if and only if one element is true and the other element is false. And the way that we can use this for a password is to break down our two strings, the secret message text and the password text, into byte arrays, and then perform the exclusive OR evaluation on each corresponding bit, which we use to build a third string. This third string, the result of the bit-by-bit exclusive OR operation, is our encrypted message. And due to a property of this exclusive OR logic, we will be able to retrieve the original message given the encoded message and the password. And that works according to these formulas here. The initial string exclusive OR password equals encoded string, and then performing the same operation with the encoded string and the password, encoded string exclusive OR password equals initial string. Again, in a minute, I'll be going into the code to show more detail on how this is achieved. So now for the actual steganography, where we encode our encrypted message into the image. As I mentioned before, we will need to iterate over each pixel of the image until we reach the end of the text message we are embedding. And for each pixel, we retrieve the RGB value and then retrieve the specific color value from that based on whether we're trying to embed in the red, green, or blue. We'll take that value, which is an integer ranging from 0 to 255, and convert it to a binary string in order to manipulate it. And now is where the concept of the least significant bit comes into play once we have that binary string. We're using the common representation here, which is called little endian form, meaning our values are, the lower value columns are on the right-hand side, just like in our normal base 10 decimal number representation. Therefore, we can see that the values of each column starting from the right and going left are 2 to the 0 power, or the 1s column, 2 to the 1st, or the 2s column, and so on through 2 to the 7th power, a column where a positive bit would represent a value of 128. The 1s column, on the other hand, can only influence the overall number by 1, and so storing our bit there will have the least impact on our color value, which remember ranges from 0 to 255, and we're only possibly altering it by 1, and that's why we call that the least significant bit. And another thing to note, and why I say only possibly altering that overall number by 1, is that sometimes we'll find the bit in that least significant bit position will be the same value that we want to embed. And so that will further help decrease the impact we're having on the image visually. Finally, once we've reached the end of our message, we want to stop iterating over the pixels to be efficient, and also leave a flag to signal the end of our message, which we can look for in the decoding process in order to also stop that once we've reached the end of our message. So now I think it would be helpful to start going through some of the code, so I've switched to that here. And here we start with our encrypt function, where we apply the exclusive OR cipher. And you'll notice it accepts the message string and the password string, both already converted to byte arrays, and it also returns a byte array. So after we set up some counters to keep track of which bit and byte of the password we're on, as well as a mutable list of bytes which will hold our encrypted result, and we initialize a byte string that we'll be using to store each individual byte to add to that list. Then we loop through each bit and byte of the original message with this nested loop, and using exclusive OR logic, which returns true if and only if one input is true and the other is false. So in our case here, that'll mean if the inputs are different, it'll return true. So if the password bit is not equal to the current message bit, we write a 1, otherwise we write a 0. Then we update our counters to see if we need to move the byte counter of the password bit. And if we're at the end of a byte, we can add that to our list up here of encrypted bytes. And then at the end, we just return that converted to a byte array. And this leads us to our encoding function up here, which is where the logic actually starts. You'll see that encrypt is called from within here. So here we set up some variables, including getting the bitmap from our image view, and also setting up array for the new RGB colors that we're going to build the new bitmap out of. And then we will do a quick check of the message link to see if it's too long to store within our image. Because remember, since each character of the message needs 8 different pixels, since we're only storing 1 bit per pixel, it's going to be 1/8 of the total pixels, minus the 3 bytes that we need to store our ending tag. Then we encrypt the message, as you can see here. We start iterating through the pixels of the image down here. The color code variable is determined by the user selection of a red, green, or blue radio button that you'll see in the app when I run it here. So depending on that, we retrieve the value that we're interested in, and then we set the least significant bit of that component to the current bit of our message. And if I scroll down here, you can see that helper function to set the least significant bit just turns it to a binary string, chops the last one off, adds what we want, and returns it. So back up to here. After we've added the bit to the appropriate color, we update our indexes, add that color to the new color list, and then once we're done, we use that new color list to build our new bitmap. So now it's time to retrieve a message from the image. And the high-level process will generally be to again iterate over each pixel, this time retrieving the least significant bit from each color value byte of the color we're interested in, and building them up into a byte array and ultimately a string. And remember, we can stop reading the pixels once we hit the 3-byte flag that we put as an ending signal. And then we will have our encrypted message, which we can pass back to our exclusive OR decryption. So now back to the code. Here's our function, our decode function, that gets the message from the image. First, we set up our rolling array of 3 bytes that we'll use to check against those 3 ending bytes so we know when we're done reading. Again, we iterate through each pixel, get the color value, and then from that, the least significant bit of whichever color we're focusing on, and add that to a string of bits. Again, we have a bit counter here to keep track, so once we have 8 bits, we update our last 3 bytes and add the current byte to our result. Then reset the bit string in the index and repeat until the last 3 bytes array contains our ending bytes. Now we have our decrypted message here, so we pass it to our decrypt function down here, which again is exactly the same. As I said, this time, if we do the same exclusive OR operation with the encrypted message, exclusive OR password, the result will be the original unencrypted message. So finally, I'll do a quick demo here just to show that this actually works. So we'll go ahead, build and run the program. Now, I don't know if you saw my splash screen, but it is a Stegosaurus. So here I have a default image that I use. And we'll just go ahead and encode some messages in various channels. Give them passwords like red password, green password, blue password. So then I hit encode. You can see now it has been encoded, and that image is the new image, although you probably can't tell. So now I switch to the green, and I'll put a distinct message and password in the green, encode that. And finally do the same for the blue. Now that I have all those in there, I'll just go ahead and copy this new image with all the messages embedded. And I'll swipe over to my decode tab here. As you can see, it's got the same image by default, but we can go ahead and see this one doesn't have the messages on it, nothing. But if I go ahead and paste what I have here, then decode, now we get the red channel secret message. Check the green, and I'll intentionally use the wrong password on the green here. And you see, without the right password, you just get a garble. But if I go back and use the correct password, now we're getting the green message. And finally, password was it? There it is, the blue message. And so as you can see, it's mostly meant to be interacted with copy and paste and share. There is functions to load and save, but I think it's much easier to copy paste and then also use the share button. We can integrate with anything you might be using, any social media, messaging, whatever. And so that's it. So finally, just to wrap up, as I mentioned before, I did notice a lot of things that needed fixing, so I have sort of a to-do list with this. One big thing is deprecated methods, because the Android API changes very quickly. So if you've left something sit for a year, you're probably going to come back and find lots of things that you need to do in the new way. Also, the main thing I need to do is I have these encode and decode operations, which are long running, but they are running on the main thread. So you couldn't really notice it when I was doing the demo earlier because I have a pretty decent laptop. But running the same app on my low quality physical Android phone, those operations freeze the UI for several seconds. So I need to put them on a separate thread and put up a some sort of progress bar just to let the user know what's going on. Also, view binding could eliminate a lot of the boilerplate code that I saw. I saw a lot of view declarations that didn't need to be in there. So that would be an easy fix as well. And finally, here's credit to the theme I used. And that's all I have. Thank you.
That was really cool, wasn't it? I'm impressed. I wish we were able to do that when he was in the internship, but I promised him that I would show it at another time. And now it will be on PGI Pods at some point, too. We do put Masterclass on PGI Pods. That will be our last one for this evening. I did have another one, but I have to put it together. It's audio. It's a separate audio and video. So I'll have to put that together before I can show it. But I want to say congratulations to all the presenters this evening. Great job. Excellent work. Lots of information. I love it every time. Did such a great job, everybody. Be proud of what you have accomplished. Getting past those nerves, right? You got to fight through it. So does anybody have any questions for any of our presenters this evening? Yeah, lots of great stuff. I know. I learn so much every time. It's wonderful. All right. Well, then I will say thank you for everybody joining and getting to watch some great presentations from all our wonderful interns. Such big brains. It's wonderful. I love the research that you guys have put into this and giving us that information. Excellent. Have a great evening, everybody. And see you around the business, huh? In the company. Have a great night.